Hello, hello. I am Eddie Edmonds, Deadpool from the CGS Forum, and welcome to the PPRD, or Paranormal Podcast for Research and Defense. This podcast has been set up to take an in-depth look at Hellboy and everything Hellboy related. We're going to take a deep in look into his universe. Just a little bit about me. I am quite a big Hellboy fan. I've not the biggest one out there, but obviously I love him enough to just start my own podcast. But I got started a while ago when I saw the Big Blast figure in my local comic book store. I then got a gift of Blade 2 on DVD from my mate for Christmas. Listening to the audio commentary, Guillermo del Toro mentions how one of the characters, Scud, is wearing a BPRD t-shirt, and that Hellboy was going to be his next movie. When I was next in my comic shop, I asked the manager behind the counter about it, who was quite a big Hellboy fan himself, probably the biggest one I've ever met, and he set me on to Hellboy and has been love ever since and a pain to my wallet. So what we're aiming to do with this podcast is set up and look at Hellboy, as you probably have guessed from my rantings and ravings. One way I'm thinking about doing this, and this may change as we're going on, is taking a look at each issue sort of as it goes. I'd like to take a look at new issues as they come out, news to deal with actors, and news to deal with Mike Mignola, Guillermo del Toro, news with the animated films and the live-action films, maybe do a few audio commentaries of that, just sort of taking it as we go. Now, I'm going to apologize for the quality of this podcast as we go along, because this is a test podcast. So if you actually are listening to this, it means somehow, incredibly, I have not fucked up and I've got it out there. And so I apologize for the pure shittiness of how this podcast is going to come about. Hopefully, as I sort of stumble my way through the dark, I'll figure out what to do. I did a bit of sound editing back in university, and I got 98 out of 100, which was pretty good. But one of the things about it was I had a fairly crappy English teacher, and if any of you have seen Gordon Ramsay on TV, he was quite a bit like that. So I really did study hard and knuckle down just to piss him off that he thought I was his shittiest student and I could prove him wrong. And it seemed to be a good teaching technique till it's sort of 3 years out since that course now, and I've forgotten everything I've learned. Plus, I've also swapped over to a Mac because I'm not a computer person, which is going to be another problem doing this podcast, is I don't know how to use a computer well or speak well or English. Now, but I'm babbling on. So let's start with taking a good in-depth look at the very first issue of Hellboy. It isn't the first one that comes out. Little background information. Hellboy came out with the San Diego Comic-Con comic number 2, and then later on appeared in John Byrne's Next Men. That is Next Men, not the X-Men. So they were his first two appearances, but for most they were introduced to Hellboy through the first issue in the mini-series Seed of Destruction. Now that's cover date March 1994, which was, 14 years ago now. Lovely cover. It was a story and script by Mike Mignola, creator of Hellboy. The script was also worked on by John Byrne. Now, there's an interesting story with John Byrne being a part of this, and that's that Mike Mignola is quite a famous artist during the 80s. In fact, one of the first comics I ever remember reading is John Byrne... not John Byrne. Jesus. Okay, and you're beginning to see the trouble with this podcast already. It is Mike Mignola's work on Gotham by Gaslight. And he'd done other things, such as The Hulk. He did a translation of Bram Stoker's Dracula for Marvel. He did a Doctor Doom book with Doctor Strange that is on the Wizards 100 Trades You Must Read Before You Die list. Unfortunately, it's not a easy trade to come by. I've been searching for it since. So he was a competent artist, but his writing had been severely lacking up until this point, and he really wanted to get on with his own work but wasn't feeling too confident with his skills in the writing field. So he approached his mate John Byrne, and they've sat down and written out this first miniseries together. But one of the things I find interesting about it is a lot of Hellboy fans tend to find that Seed of Destruction is the worst Hellboy book in terms of story aspects, which is funny because Byrne quite is quite an accomplished writer. Now, obviously Mike Mignola has learned what he needed from him and moved on to greater success. So you'll probably find, flipping through this first book of Seed of Destruction, there's a lot of word blocks, speech block. I know word balloons in comics from the character's mouth, but I'm trying to think of what they're called when they're the little squares on the top of the page. I'm obviously showing my comic novice here. You know, you'd think after 22 years of reading comics, I'd know a bit more. But I'm rambling on now. Now, the other person who worked on this was Mark Cheriello. Cheriello. I don't know how you pronounce that, so Cheriello, I'm making fun of your name. Hopefully you never hear this. But Mark Cheriello was the colorist. Now, this sort of shocked me as I was going through doing my research for this podcast, because as most Hellboy fans would know, Dave Stewart is quite famous for doing the coloring for Hellboy, and part of me just assumed that Dave Stewart had been on from the start, but he hadn't been. Mike Cheriello's colors seem to be still quite the same level for this. Obviously a bit different. It was the 90s as we go through this book, and quite a thing to take into account. It really is not a 90s book, Hellboy, but comparing it to the later Hellboy works, there are some things that really do stand out as it being 90s, and the color is a little different from today's standard of Hellboy coloring, but still completely different from what you'd assume in the 90s. So let's begin. If you have a first issue of Hellboy Seed of Destruction handy, you can go through it with me. It will be quite fun little read as my annoying voice is in your ear trying to get it through. Just say, shut up, Eddie, and I won't, because I'm a podcast. You need to push the pause button. Now, I'm just going through with the trade version of it. Now, that's not to say I am a little Hellboy fan. I am a big Hellboy fan, but my single issue at the moment is actually framed on my wall. I'm looking at it as we speak, and I can't be bothered breaking a frame open just to do this podcast. You're not that special. So if you have the trade, that's more than fine enough. I'm assuming the single issue is pretty much the same. Now, the first page of the story opens up to a journal of George Whitmore, a sergeant in the US Army. Opening shots of Gothic architecture in England. Now, this is quite a good opening, I feel, since that Gothic architecture plays a major role in the Hellboy universe from this point out. It's, if you don't like Gothic architecture, this book really is not going to be for you. So if you haven't read Hellboy before, you might want to switch off now, because examining Gothic architecture is probably going to take up a bit on the... Maybe I should make a note of that to do some research into Gothic architecture for later discussions. But anyway, moving on, within the first sort of paragraph of the journal, we get mention of the Nazis. Now, this is wonderful, because the Nazis are quite a good villain, as the Indiana Jones films will pray evidence to. Nazis just work as bad guys, I feel, because they really, no one's going to stick their hand up in this day and age and say, hey, I'm a Nazi and I take offense to that. You know, what are you doing making fun of my Nazism? You know, that they work as bad. They were bad guys. They did horrible atrocities, and not meaning to make light of them, but they did things that literally were considered evil. And so they just work on that sort of back present. There's that Nazi symbol does drill fear into you. I know it's a Buddhist symbol for those who are going to write in, but let's face it, you see that symbol these days with the red and the white, and you think Nazi, not swastika, well, you think swastika. I don't know if that's the Buddhist term for it, but it's Nazi that it is stand for these days. But I digest. Now we move through. Now on the second page, as we flip over, there's a superhero-looking character standing in the middle of the group, and that's the Torch of Liberty. Now, this is quite an interesting aspect, and one of my things that I always look at when reading Seed of Destruction. The Torch of Liberty was a John Byrne character, one of his superheroes at Dark Horse Comics. It's obviously a Captain America archetype, and it sort of shocked me when I first read this, because I had no idea that John Byrne had this character and was sort of giving him a cameo in this Hellboy book. I thought he was going to be a Hellboy character. And it sort of shocked me, because I was expecting sort of this horror book. If you flip over to the back of the trade, it has in the top corner, graphic novel horror. And so I was expecting this to be... Actually, no. I'm telling a complete lie. I was not expecting Hellboy to be horror at first. I remember reading a review of Hellboy that summed up his origin as a stuff-up in the administration of hell, and he wound up on the side of the good guys. So I thought it was going to be a bit more of those wacky comedies, and with a title like Hellboy, you know, and what were you to assume? But as Mitch, my local comic store manager, told me, it was more of the horror-based thing. So by the time I actually got around to reading it, I was assuming it was more horror-based. So seeing this superhero amongst the mix sort of threw things off a bit, and it sort of set me up to a feel it was going to be a bit more like the Ninja Turtles, you know, where you've sort of got these monster mutated characters at your sort of forefront, but inhabiting a world full of superheroes. So, nice little pug for John Byrne's Torch of Liberty character there, even though he really doesn't come back. There's a reference to him later on being the one who gave Hellboy the gun, and I believe in another issue later on he talks about the Torch of Liberty training him how to shoot the gun. But as he points out in the film, he's not a very good shot. So I wonder how good Torch of Liberty was. He doesn't seem to be carrying a gun in any of these sort of shots, and if he's a superhero archetype. But I haven't actually read any Torch of Liberty. Here's one to put out to you, Hellboy fans. Should reading Torch of Liberty be considered part of Hellboy canon? Is it the same universe? Does Torch of Liberty been reconned into the Hellboy U? So there's one for maybe a future discussion. But moving on, we're introduced to more prevalent heroes in this Hellboy U, which is Trevor Broom, or Bratolahom. As if you were to read it from the way they actually write. Luckily, from this journal entry, the captain luckily pronounced Broom in his own journal entry. Very, very nice of him. Don't know who he was assuming would be reading his journal later on, but there you go. He also mentions there is a Malcolm Frost and a Cynthia Edna Jones, and these people are part of the British Paranormal Society brought in. Obviously, Broom becomes a main character down the line, even though he gets killed off in 5 pages. And I don't think Malcolm Frost came back again. He could. I'm probably getting booed at by my screens by the fellow Hellboy fans, but I think he comes back in one of the giant ones with the Wolf Hunter. Was that him? I don't think it was, but sort of looking at this picture now, sort of seems to be. One thing I find, as much as I am a Hellboy fan, I do get lost in some of these side characters that Broom knows in sort of the short, old-fashioned stories. Sometimes I feel like they are the same characters when they're not, and sometimes I feel like they're different characters again. So I apologise to any diehard fans that I'm actually killing for and who are wondering why such a novice has a podcast, but I will say this again, I'm doing this more out of love for the character than my actual knowledge. Then we go on, we discover they're there to stop the Project Ragnarok, which if they are reading Walt Simonson's Thor, they would know is a pretty bad thing these Nazis must be working on. Maybe it was some sort of thing where the Nazis got their hands on Walt Simonson's Thor and thought, oh, that's a good idea, look at that. Okay. Bad jokes aside, Cynthia Edna Jones has told them something will happen, and no, they can't say it. It will happen tonight, so, ooh, creepy. Broom establishes that he's actually been studying this place for years, and that something horrible happened years ago, and it's been wiped the minds of everyone. No one wants to remember it. It was so bad, sort of like the second Charlie's Angel movie. But, so this is sort of setting up Hellboy's origin later on, as you'll find out, which is something I'm going to discuss when Hellboy actually appears, but we'll move on from here. She says to wait, there's a second center, of which point we cross to Scotland, where the Nazis are. Scotland, Isles, not normally known for hosting Nazis, but there you go. Where we have Von Krupp, Cronin. Now, we often have discussions about the pronunciation of Cronin in our comic shop, even though it's clearly stated in the film at some point, we never can seem to remember it. So if you hear me say Cronin once again, just yell at your podcast and you'll look like an idiot, but eventually I might be able to hear it. And we've got to Rasputin. Now, this was one of the big selling factors to me, because at the time I picked this book up, I was still in high school and just studied the Russian Revolution, and Rasputin really was one of the more interesting parts of the history. Now, he's standing here with the big robotic gizmos on his arm, which do sort of represent the Hands of Doom, and as I think they did quite well in the film version, they only put it on one hand and sort of gave it that representation of the right hand of Doom. And he charges it up, they do the normal Star Trek, "It just won't hold, Captain," but German accent, followed through, lightning strikes, big verbal warning, which is sort of, I'm interested to sort of go through this sort of speech that Rasputin does. He has things like Heralds of Pestilence, which for those of you who know the Frogman story later on sort of bears fruit to future comings, and Knowing No Mercy, obviously a bad guy thing, Spill Blood Like Rain, Devour Flesh, yeah, Let the Seven Now Rise from the Abyss, yes, Heedless They Are, Prey on Suspicion, The Wild Storm, Furious Beast, Evil Winds They Are, sort of just setting up these people are not friendly people. But I was sort of looking through it before to see if there was anything sort of predicting the future, but apart from that Heralds of Pestilence, I don't think there overly is. Edna Jones saying, you know, more woes in the world, things are coming. They notice something going on. Close up, and they see the ghosts of the priest and the nun. Now, this is obviously setting up a bit more of the origin of Hellboy, which we'll get told in later books. Which I believe Chain Coffin is the one that really comes back to these two characters. But this was one of the things where only a couple pages in and already we got hints to a bunch of different stories that take place later on. This is one of my favourite things about Hellboy. He really does subtly set up a comings of future storylines. It's quite fascinating when it really makes it rereadable that you can go back and reread these book 100 times, and even though there's 4 panels on a page, you really get so much out of it. And it's one of the things I really love is his artwork. It's just Mike Mignola. I'm going to go off on a rant here and talk about Mike Mignola's art, just in his subtlety of setting things up in the future, because there's really not too much on the page here. He sets up a whole scene with, you know, only a couple of lines on the face. He's not like Brian Hitch or anything like that. In fact, complete opposite to someone like Alec Ross, who really is, to me, the greatness of Alec Ross comes from his colour work. But when you look at the level of detail, if you really were to pick at it, there's not too much there. But he hints at the detail that's there, and in your mind you really do see it. And it's just something to do with, he gets as much across with as simple as possible, and it really is brilliant. I can't describe how, with so little detail, he can give you so much to your mind. But moving on, Torture Liberty looks like he's about to set out on his adventure, and oh, he saves the girl, Edna Jones, who was standing in the wrong spot. Big yellow explosion in front of the Jesus statue, and cut back to Rasputin, who's sort of in a similar pose to Jesus on the cross minus the cross. I don't know if there was symbolism there, but there you go. Jesus with his Nazi symbol on his chest. A bit of weird stereotype. Don't tell your Catholic mother. Von Kropt is a bit sarcastic with him. And here comes the sort of Boba Fett moment where these guys are obviously mean Nazis, but Rasputin talks back to him without any fear, and that is one of the classic setups for a good villain, is have someone who knows a bad villain and have someone talk back to him. Everyone remembers that scene in Empire Strike Back where Boba Fett says, yeah, well, he's worth a lot to me, and he's sort of doing it here. I have set motions in vent. I was just trying to do a really horrible accent again, and lucky you, I'm going to try and do it again. I have set in motion events which cannot be reversed or undone. I promised Hitler a miracle. And I have made one. I don't know if that was Russian or not, but there you go, I tried. Now, turning over to the next page is the first time in comic book form we actually get to see Hellboy. If you were shocked by this, you obviously didn't look at the cover very hard enough, but he's standing here in sort of the midst of fire, sort of very similar to the Savage Dragon origin, which would have came out the year, a couple of, maybe, was it the year before? Maybe three. It was either 91 or 93. So, and considering Hellboy goes on to guest appear shortly in Savage Dragon, I wonder if Mike Mignola might have stolen a bit of his origin from there. Now, one thing I find interesting about this first panel of Hellboy's appearance is in the background there are statues, and they're sort of brushing off Hellboy. One sort of looking in disgust, and the other's got his hand up, not liking it. It's these sort of little details, which I may be reading too much in, but I really like that. I really get the sense that the statues are almost us. We're almost watching from the statue eyes point of view. Now, they do the classic, oh my god, monster, and then Torch of Liberty, you know, bravely and very Superman-ish. He doesn't look dangerous to me, Professor. Very pulpy, actually, when you have someone calling someone Professor, but that may just be me. Looks like a little boy, and then the classic broom line made famous in the film. Hellboy. Bad William Hurt impression there. And then the photo, which is one of my favourite pieces of Mike Mignola art. I don't know if they've made a poster of this, but they really should. The classic Hellboy with the troop one. Just fantastic art. This podcast has just gotten really boring as I'm just raving on about Mike Mignola art. And then we cut to 1994. Set in New York, one of my favourite cities in the world. Scott's Broom sort of revisiting old tapes and explains how it was only 50 years ago, more like 50 now, as he says, closer to 50 now. In the time I'm recording this podcast, it's more like 64, but there you go. And he talks about how old he's getting, to which a voice replies, "You look just fine to me, sir." Now, this is the first line that we get from Hellboy, and I find it quite interesting that he's talking about looks. It's maybe one of those things, once again, I'm reading a bit too much into, but the little things like that that I can look back on that makes me feel like this work is so much deeper and yet really subtle at the same time, not like Watchmen, which is glass castle breaking while a snow globe breaks, you know. Sorry to offend anyone, but as deep as Watchmen is and as wonderfully written as Watchmen is, I like myself a bit of subtlety. Now, the next page where we actually see the first adult Hellboy, I really do love. It's got Professor Broom, and he's sitting there in the light while Hellboy is actually in more of the darker side of the room, and he has a lot more horror-based statues around, and one looks like it's from the Kali cult from Temple of Doom. And it's just little things like this. It sort of sets up a bit like the scene from Psycho with Norman Bates standing with the stuffed birds behind him. Now, if you really look on these next couple of pages, you're really starting to see the text blocks and the little thought squares. And this was something at the time. Comics had a lot of these. You'd really would spend about 10 to 15 minutes reading the comic as today, where you're spending about 5 to 10. And a lot of it was these thought things, which some people really do claim to miss, but I really don't, because often they're just going over what we're seeing in the picture. And as I said before, I'm a bit more of a fan of subtlety. But it does give you some information in these ones. It is one of the more better written ones, but it's weird reading a Hellboy one, which these days is a hell of a lot more visual, to have all this sort of writing covering up the wonderful artwork. Now, Hellboy sort of says, you know, his father's been away and he's looking a bit more sick and grievous. And this is something to really look at. As someone who has had a parent figure sort of go through a cancer-like state and really wither in front of you, and you really sort of have moments where you step back and look at them and say, you know, hey, this isn't the person that raised me, you know. They're just sort of a frail shell of that. And it's not meaning to take away from the manner of the character at all, or the manner of the person, but it really is quite a scary thing to see. And I really get the sense in Hellboy's face, he's sort of not even, well, you can't see his pupils, but he's sort of not even looking at Broom, and it's sort of setting something up to me that he's known something isn't quite right with him as he's sort of entered the room. Now, speaking of the pupils, was something I forgot to mention before. In this prologue thing, and once again, I may be reading too deep into it, but Broom, Cynthia Jones, and Rasputin are the only characters you ever see the pupils of during the prologue. And these are also the characters that really do become the major ones down the line. So I'm wondering whether Mike Mignola was setting that up at all. He really doesn't show pupils that much, but certain characters like Broom, who I'm sensing he wanted a lot more familiar presence with, had it, and also Rasputin, but Rasputin one are the more cold dead eyes. On Broom and Cynthia, they're sort of, the pupil eyes are looking off in the distance. It's not as penetrating to you, whereas the Rasputin ones are dead on now. Those of you who have studied Rasputin know that a lot of people believed his hypnotic power came through his eyes. So moving back through, we get the history story of Broom taking off with the Cavendish men who have sought to find this place up in the Himalaya regions for ages, which comes back greatly down in the BPRD storylines. These Cavendish family will end up plaguing a lot of Hellboy and his friends' adventures in the past, but here's Broom tracking off through the mountains, and they discover the old resting place of Rasputin. Now, this storyline is was given more to the bad guys in the film, which sort of does make sense in itself, but I sort of like this idea of both fathers sort of waking, you know, Rasputin wakes Hellboy, who's raised by Broom, who wakes Rasputin. It's sort of this weird triangle thing, so I don't know if that'll be completed down the line with Hellboy waking up Broom in some sort of capacity and sort of being a weird circle arch or something of that respect. We have Broom saying he can't remember the adventure, which is obviously a bad sign when you're dealing with the paranormal. And now, here's one of the other subtle things that I really love. The very first scene here with Hellboy is adult state. He's comforting this old man who seems to be having a bit of a breakdown. And you've got to remember, this is a 90s comic. And so your normal cliche would be to have him smashing something or punching someone in the head. But no, he's sort of caring for this old man. And it really helps to sort of set up the nature of who Hellboy really is. He's a genuinely good person on the inside. But obviously devil-looking fellow on the outside with what appear to be goggles on his head, as most of you who read this before other material came out. I got to admit, I put it out there, I was one of the people who thought he had goggles on his head. Don't ask me why, they look like goggles. Now, and apparently Guillermo del Toro admitted to himself he thought they were goggles too. Now we have him still sort of simping. Then frogs burst into the room. Now, I really like this imagery of frogs because frogs are, they're creepy in a way that's not like spiders or bugs or rats or something like that. They're not diseasey or something like that. They're just, they're sort of odd creatures. They're bizarre. Plus, they play a great deal into mythology. And I believe in the back of the trade there's a little frog myth, but then you've got like the laughing toad of the Aboriginal myth. And of course, you've got the plague of Moses. And frogs become a great form of symbolism throughout the Hellboy sort of story. So here we have the frogs coming in. Obviously awakens something in this Broom fella who appears to be either drunk or cold because he's got a very red nose. Maybe he didn't go anywhere at all and he's just been sitting here drinking the whole time. But needless to say, he runs out of the room saying to Hellboy to save himself in a green speech bubble. I don't know if anyone else has that, but it sort of stands out as being a bit odd to me. Sir, as Hellboy says, sir, and then crashing through the door, the dead body of Broom. One of the most important characters in the Hellboy mythos. And he's dead within the first five pages of the book. Obviously, being told through flashback, we learn a bit more about old Broom here, but it really did shock me on reading this. I thought he would stick around a bit more than this. He really was a great character, and I don't know whether it's because we've had him expanded upon in the past, but I seem to remember feeling quite fond of him at the time, and there he's gone. But here we have one of the great uses of these sort of thought blocks, which is Hellboy talking about when he does stupid things. And he says the stupidest thing he does is dive into a dark room without thinking. And this really set up the character for me. I still remember actually reading this page for the first time and thinking, you know, here we go, he's a good character. He's big, he's strong, he's going to be a hard fella to take down. But he is a bit ruled by his emotions, and chances are if he's going down, it's going to be his own dumb mistake that does it. And it holds true. He does often jump into these dark places without thinking, and that's where he seems to get himself into trouble. If you watch, that's often where he's captured or knocked out. He's falling into a dark place, stumbling into a dark place, or even just following some weird vampire butler into a dark place. And here we also have the first appearance of the Frogmen, who will become like the stormtroopers of the Hellboy universe. They're jump there. Fantastic creatures. For those of you who actually haven't read the comics and have only sort of seen the films, the Samael characters from the first film were really based off of them, which as much as I love Guillermo del Toro's work, and I really am a big Guillermo del Toro fan, I wondered constantly why he just didn't go with these frogmen as the characters in that film, because they basically are the same characters. He only really added tentacles to the back of the head and gave him a different background history. And I just really like these frogmen better. Just these werewolf frog type creatures is really, I love them. This is why I love the book. Dark thing, werewolf frogs. Who the hell can come up with werewolf frogs? Yeah, this is comics to me. Werewolf frogs. Write that down. Tell your grandmother. Werewolf frogs. Now here we are. Hellboy hitting him, big stone fists, obviously got a normal hand. Now, I've always wondered this as a left-hander. Is Hellboy a lefty? Does he write with his left? Does he turn the tap on with his left? Does he, pleasure himself with his left hand? I really think it would be quite awkward if he tried to pleasure himself with his right one. Maybe he uses his tail. But he gives it a good whammy, the frogman, that is. Sends through, fights, smashes him into a Egyptian sarcophagi. I don't know if there's only one, so sarcophagus, sarcophagi may be plural. It's through, smash, smash. Now here is the biggest 90s moment for me in the book. The frogman sees Hellboy pull the gun and says, you know, oh, he must obviously know what a gun is, he's running from it. Which is good characterization, makes the frogmen not seem like just mindless creatures. But Hellboy's thinking to himself, it happens in the bathroom and he's going outside, will he get away? And then the speech bubble, like hell. Like hell, get it? It's quite a pun that could easily go over your heads. His name's Hellboy, and here he is with a pun, like hell. Just reeks of 90s that moment to me, but you know, you can't blame it. I'm hopefully chalking that line up to John Byrne and not Mike Mignola trying to please the Liefeld crowd. Liefeld fans, don't hate me. Keep in mind my name on the CGS forums is Deadpool. I'm not a hater of Liefeld, but you know what I'm going for here. Okay, so moving on, the Frogman dies and burns up. Now we cut to the Bureau of Paranormal Research and Defense, or the BPRD, which me just making fun of stupid puns before is where I got the title for this podcast, the PPRD. I think mine's more catchy. You get two P's. Anyway, BPRD, where we sort of see a first glimpse at Tom Manning, who was played by Jeffrey Tambor in the film version from Arrested Development, and also my favourite name to use while doing prank phone calls. So if you ever get a weird prank phone call from a guy named Jeffrey Tambor, chances are it's me on the other end of the line. But anyway, Hellboy's sort of going through saying what happened. Now, this sort of stands out. Hellboy really doesn't seem regretful that his dad, or his surrogate dad, has just died. And it always sort of bothered me, this bit, even though later on Tom does say, look, Hellboy, sorry about old Broomy boy. I know you were close, which it sort of does set it up. But Hellboy himself doesn't seem to show it. And that's one thing that does always bother me, because he's such a kid. He's huggable. You want to hug him, and you think he would have a bigger heart when his dad just died. But 90s comment needed to move the plot along, so there you go. He's got a nice sort of triangle lamp in his office there, old Tom Manning. And he says, well, gentlemen, look like something messy has just set afoot. And then we have a look into what we'll later know to become the Cavendish Manor, where a dark, shadowy figure, Rasputin, is standing there talking to Emma Cavendish, who we haven't heard yet. But we're going to figure out she's an evil, creepy woman, because there's a frog in her teacup. So either she's quite a bit old dottery and is a bit confused when it came to making green tea, or she's connected to the frog werewolf fella from before. And that sort of closes up the first issue of Hellboy Seed of Destruction. I hope I haven't bored you too long with this analysis of the book. So let me hear what you think of this, if this does make it out. I haven't set up a email address, I'm just realizing now, despite hearing comments. I'll set up one just for the podcast, but if this does make it out, send it to pprdcast@yahoo.com.au. Don't forget the AU, I am in Australia. Include names and ideas of topics, you know, maybe something for the mail section, what you'd call it. I was trying to think of something to do with hell and mail, but the only words when I think of hell and mail are the post office. I was thinking of also doing a segment called Out of the Fire, referencing the old saying, out of the fire and into the frying pan, because I have a lot of interest outside of Hellboy. I don't spend all my hours looking at Hellboy books, despite Hellboy being one of my favourite characters. And this will just give me a chance to vent about other comics or movies that I may be seeing at the time. I don't expect it to take up too much of a case, but so I'll just do a Out of the Fire place at the moment. I'll say that I picked up on a whim Scar, Son of the Hulk. It sounds really stupid, it's a weird title, but I was lying in bed sort of thinking to myself, Son of the Hulk, you know, Greg Pak the writer, he must have had balls to walk up to Joe Q and say, hey Joe, I've got an idea for a comic. It's called Son of the Hulk. Now remember, Marvel gets pitches for hundreds of comics, you know, from their creators and other creators and just people off the street every day. So for something about Son of the Hulk to make it into comic book form, there must have been something backing it up. And I sort of wanted to find this answer. And I checked it out, and it is sort of what a lot of people are saying, that it's a green Conan. But I don't know if any of you have read the Kurt Busiek Conan books, but they're good. So it being like Conan, don't take it as an insult at all. It turned out to be quite a good book. The art by Ron Garney was quite nice. I'd sort of give it a check out. I'm definitely... It did, as Jamie D from the CGS forums always says, it left me wanting the next issue, and this one certainly did, so I'd give that a high recommendation. Alright, so I think I've included everything I've wanted to in this sort of first test podcast. I once again apologise for the adherent shitty quality of it, but this is the first time I've ever started. In fact, it's only the second time I've ever pushed the record button on my little podcast-making device here, and I've decided to do this whole test run through at once to just sort of see how I go, because otherwise I'll sort of fiddle with it for ages and not get anything done with it. But there you go. So let me know what you thought. That email address again, pprdcast@yahoo.com.au. Don't forget the AU, I am in Australia. Or Lobo and Lord Shaper, who've sort of helped me out in sort of setting this up and giving me good advice. They've been quite good. And anyone else who I've sort of asked along the way. I know the guys in the Aussie Hangout and the CGS forum boards sort of gave me a little bit of support when I sort of suggested this idea. And hopefully here's to many more Hellboy discussions in the future. Thank you. I'm going to see.